Appearance for the record.
Ken Carpenter, Your Honor, appearing on behalf of Ms. Pose.
Thank you.
Michelle Waggle, and Jim Moriarty, appearing on behalf of Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Appellant is ready.
Yes, sir.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments. Mr. Carpenter, you go first, and you may reserve a portion of the time for rebuttal.
I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, Your Honor.
Clerk will reserve the time. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Ty Roos. During the history or pendency of this case, a number of changes have occurred in veterans' law. Those changes involve the removal of the well-groundedness requirement, which was the basis for the 1998 decision of the board in this case on a separate theory of entitlement. Also involved the bar imposed by the Federal Circuit on development of evidence by the Board of Veterans' Appeals in the first instance. And finally, it involved this Court's holding in the case of Roebuck, which recognized the singularity of a claim under multiple theories of entitlement. Ultimately, however, this case involves an interpretation of the extant regulation in 2004, which 38 CFR 19.9. concerning the board's responsibility to clarify evidence. The board's September 1998 decision does not become final until the VA's April 7, 2004 decision was submitted by the board. The board's September 1998 decision to deny Mr. Ty Roos a lung disorder claim was based upon a finding that theory of entitlement was not well-grounded, and they remanded the alternative theory under presumptive service connection. As a consequence, this decision should likewise be well-grounded as part of the, should be vacated as part of this appeal. This Court's decision in Roebuck controls the outcome in that regard. Finality attaches only after the board decided the second bifurcated theory pertaining to Mr. Ty Roos's lung claim, according to the holding of this Court in Roebuck. In this case, as in Roebuck, the VA incorrectly split the appellant's singular claim for a service-connected disability for a lung disorder into two separate claims based upon different theories of etiology. The first was based upon a direct theory of service connection, and this other was based upon a secondary based upon his Persian Gulf wartime service. Moving next to what I believe is the substantive issue in this case, which is the board's violation of its duty under 38 CFR 19.9 to have clarified the evidence when the board was, when the board directed in this case in a previous development order to develop evidence to the exclusion of a VA medical opinion which was not attempted to be clarified. The board's July 2002 development memorandum at the record at 365 to 366 violates the extant version of 19.9, which existed at the time of the April 2004 board decision. At the time of that board decision, the extant version of the regulation required the board to clarify evidence. I believe that it is undisputed in this case that there was need to clarify the opinion offered by Dr. Plum in this case. The board's error was in failing to recognize the conflict between the board's development memo in 2002 and the extant version of 19.9 when the matter was returned to the board for consideration in April of 2004. The board had an affirmative.
Mr. Carpenter, isn't the issue the difference between the order of 1989 and 272 that denied entitlement to service connection for a lung disorder on a direct basis, and whereas in Roebuck it was a lung disorder based on tobacco or a lung disorder based on asbestos, in this case the lung disorder on a direct basis, whatever that might be, was denied, and what was remanded was something different, a chronic disorder manifested by shortness of breath due to an undiagnosed illness? Something different than a diagnosed lung disorder? Isn't that the crux of this case?
Well, I think not, Your Honor. I think that
I thought so, but I wanted to hear why.
Not reasonable in Mr. Tyrese's view to separate the characterization of this lung condition which he has. He is seeking compensation for a disability resulting from a lung problem. The characterization of that, whether under the terminology used for an undiagnosed illness under the presumptive provisions for service in the Persian Gulf or on a direct basis, is a distinction which should not be permitted to prevent the application of Roebuck in this case. What is, however, more critical is the fact that at issue in this case is the fact that the board ordered the development of evidence to the exclusion of favorable evidence by Dr. Plum. Dr. Plum, in this case, offered...
When did they render that order?
In July of 2002.
And when was this order that I'm referring to?
I'm sorry, what was the...
It's 1989. 272 is the...
Oh, right. That's the 1998.
And what about on 275, 276 of the record where your the veteran was provided notice of appellate rights that specifically delineated between that portion which was denied and that portion which was remanded?
I don't think that's relevant, Your Honor, because what happened in 1998 is that the board denied the claim on the basis that it was not well-grounded. And as a consequence, the appeal of that decision was not ripe in 1998. It did not become ripe until the April 2004 decision, when the second bifurcated theory was finally decided by the board.
But that's if we accept your position, I suspect, is that it was all a lung disorder.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And didn't the board bifurcate it out and say, whatever it is, the lung disorder is not service-connected, direct service connection, and something else, undiagnosed, is what we're going to consider? Because, frankly, if you're diagnosed with a lung disorder, you don't get the Gulf War presumption.
You don't get the Gulf War presumption. That's correct, Your Honor. But that's the problem with Dr. Plum's opinion.
But that's in 2002.
2000. Actually, I believe Dr. Plum's opinion originated in 2001. The memorandum for development other than clarifying Dr. Plum's opinion happened in July of 2002.
Right, but I guess I want to go back to what I'm seeing as an issue, mm-hmm. I'd like you to talk on, and that is in 1989, any lung disability is denied for service connection direct. And this... 98, sorry, thank you. And this undiagnosed illness, some respiratory undiagnosed illness, is going to be remanded, and the medical... opinions that you're referring to come after that. So they relate to this undiagnosed illness. And there may be all sorts of problems with that. But what has that got to do with the denial of a lung disorder on a direct basis?
Because what Dr. Plum diagnosed is that Mr. Tyrus suffered from bronchitis, and that was part of the problem that the board had in 2002 when it remanded the case, because it said Dr. Plum seems to be saying two different things, that he has both an undiagnosed condition and a diagnosed condition. If he has a diagnosed condition, then we move into the direct service connected category, which was dealt with by the non-final decision of the board in 1998. In other words, by 2002, the VA had independently developed favorable...
But if it's final in 1998... I know you keep saying it's non-final, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. It's final in 1998.
But it's not final under Roebuck, Your Honor, because what happens under Roebuck is that you cannot have a final decision under a single theory of entitlement when there are bifurcated theories of entitlement to compensation for generic condition. A lung condition. And what Congress has done, rather bizarrely, I must confess, is to define a category of illnesses which are not diagnosed, which seems to be...
Which somehow get diagnosed, don't they?
Well, and as you suggest, what happens is if they get diagnosed, the presumption disappears. And that is inherently problematic with a medical system that moves to diagnose. You know, they
so
look
take me back to 1998,
diagnose.
And you receive... Your client receives this mm-hmm. notice of appellate rights that basically says what we remanded, you can't appeal, but what we denied, you can appeal.
Right.
But why isn't it appealed in 1998?
Based upon this court's decision in Roebuck.
Which didn't exist then.
Which did not exist then, no. And that issue was presented at the original briefing by Mr. Tyrese to this court that he was entitled, and Roebuck had not yet been decided at that point.
So what happened in 1998? I'm just trying to figure out. You get a notice of appellate rights, and you've got a denial with direct service connection, and they're going to go down and consider this undiagnosed illness situation. What happens in 1998?
What nothing happens. The finality of that 1998 decision is held in suspense until there is a final decision.
So the veteran sat there and said, well, I don't really need to appeal this. It's going to be held in suspense.
No, I don't think the veteran had any cognitive awareness of what his circumstances were, notwithstanding the fact that he did get that notice of appellate rights. Had he gotten that notice of appellate rights and gone to counsel in 1998, then counsel would have advised him to appeal that. But that's part of the inherent justice of the holding in Roebuck, as is evidenced by what happened in this case. In 2001, the VA actually developed evidence of an existing lung condition, of bronchitis.
So would that be evidence that would allow the claim to be reopened?
It would
if it had been
a final decision, yes. But since it is not a final decision, since what Roebuck does is to hold...
Can the board reopen a claim sua sponte?
Can the board reopen a claim? So, yes, I believe they probably can. Under the Jackson decision, the Federal Circuit held that the question of reopening is jurisdictional, and even if the VA decides that there was new and material evidence, that the board can revisit that. So it would seem to me that the converse of that would surely be true.
Do you need the chairman to designate that first?
If you were in a situation in which you had a final decision, yes. But we are not in that situation in light of Roebuck. And in light of the fact that this case was pending at the time in which Roebuck was decided and remains pending before this court at this point. This case was appealed to the Federal Circuit.
But there are differences between this and Roebuck. Roebuck clearly was a lung disability arising out of tobacco use, or a lung disability arising out of asbestos use. And this is a lung disability denied for direct service connection and some other unknown disability, undiagnosed disability, that was still being processed.
But with respect, Your Honor, you're making the same distinction that was rejected in Roebuck. It is a lung disability. There are merely two separate theories of entitlement. And to try to make that artificial differentiation is precisely what was rejected by this court in Roebuck. There is only one disability sought, and that is for a disability related to the lung. Whether it has a label and it qualifies under direct service connection, or it doesn't have a label and it qualifies for presumptive service connection because it's an undiagnosed condition.
Is the Federal Circuit's decision in Boggs then implicated in all of this? In Boggs, the Federal Circuit said in the context of a general claim for hearing problems that two separate etiologies constituted two separate claims.
But as I recall, Boggs was in the context of, again, the question of reopening. And we're not in the context of reopening. And I believe that Boggs is limited to an analysis of whether there should be a 5108 hurdle when there is a different theory of etiology that is being presented after one theory of etiology was rejected in a final decision. In this case, quite frankly, because they never reached the merits in 1998 and only rejected it on the basis of lack of well-groundedness, it's hard to really suggest that it was rejected based upon a source of etiology. It was rejected because it didn't meet the then threshold of well-groundedness. But under Roebuck, that 1998 decision simply cannot be found to be final. It's not a final decision until the board acts again in April of 2000.
I guess what I'm really asking, and you've sort of answered it, I think, is does Boggs trump Roebuck?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor, because Boggs deals with the context of reopening, and this is not a reopening case, as I had discussed with Judge Castle. The only way this can become a reopening case and Boggs would then apply would be a circumstance in which the 1998 decision was final. The other distinction with Boggs is that you aren't dealing with different ideological sources. The direct service connection is related to something that occurred during service. Since the 1998 decision never got to the merits, it never made a merit determination as to whether there was or wasn't a relationship to service on any ideological basis. What they did, however, do was to find that there was another potential theory of entitlement under presumptive service connection.
Mr. Carpenter, with the 4 minutes and 22 seconds that you have remaining, under your duty to assist claim, explain to me how your client was prejudiced, understanding that your client may or may not have a responsibility of proving prejudice.
Okay. The prejudice occurred when the board in April of 2004 failed to comply with its own regulation, which required the board to seek clarification of Dr. Plum's 2001 opinion. And in fact, what the board permitted to stand was the July 2002 memorandum, which directed the VA to obtain another medical opinion and expressly directed him, to the prejudice of Mr. Tyrus, to not seek clarification from Dr. Plum. Had they sought clarification from Dr. Plum, and that clarification substantiated either a direct service-connected basis or a presumptive basis, then the case would have been over. There would have been no need to get that additional opinion. And what they ended up doing was circumventing, as frankly occurred in the Schaffner case. But in the Schaffner case, the VA had made a good faith effort to contact the private physician and had been unable to get a response from the private physician, so they sought that additional opinion. And this court held in Schaffner that that was not a violation, not of 19.9, but of 5103 under the notice and the duty to assist requirements of the VCAA. However, in a footnote in Judge in the dissent in Schaffner, Judge Steinberg does make reference to the then extant version of 19.9 and specifically suggests that there is a duty. He was talking under that version of the statute to the procedural defect. This is not a procedural defect. This is a specific direction for the clarification of evidence. And that's what we have here. We have an opinion from a VA physician which contained favorable evidence, and that favorable evidence, if clarified, could have potentially substantiated the claim on either of the two available theories of entitlement. Therefore, Mr. Tyrus was clearly prejudiced by not having that opinion clarified by the VA physician who had offered it and, in fact, had been directed under the then authority of the board to develop evidence independently to obtain an opinion from a physician other than Dr. Plum. Clearly, Mr. Tyrus was prejudiced as a result of that.
Roebuck is based on a jurisdictional concept of whether or not portions of a claim can be appealed, which I think arises out of Harris and inextricably intertwined concepts, et cetera. Is this really a jurisdictional issue, or is this an issue of where the board determines that something is final, it can be appealed, and the court will either address it or determine that it's so intertwined we will send it back? And it's not a jurisdictional issue, but rather a judicial economy consideration for the court to make.
I'm not so sure about that, Your Honor. I don't really see this as being jurisdictional, nor, quite frankly, do I see Roebuck as being jurisdictional. It is only
the only reason the 89 claim continued to survive, at least as I read Roebuck, is because if it didn't, if you had appealed it, you would have been thrown out potentially for lack of jurisdiction, because it was all one claim.
The reverse, in other words, the direct appeal, and you keep saying 1998.
I'm sorry,
I got very confused there with the transposition. Yes, the 1998 decision is non-final, and a direct appeal this court would not have had jurisdiction of, and that would be correct. But there was no appeal taken of that, and in fact there was an appeal taken of the April 2004. That's what's before this court, and the question is does this court's jurisdiction reach to consideration of what happened in 1998? And I think the answer under Roebuck is clearly yes.
Thank you very much. You have 10 minutes left. Ms. Wagle, did I say that right?
Wagle. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Nisha Wagle, and accompanying me at Counselor's table is Joan Moriarty, Assistant Deputy General Counsel. Today I'm representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, James B. Peek. Appellant is mistaken to categorize diagnosed and undiagnosed claims as two theories of the same claim. Here we have a claim for service connection for a diagnosed respiratory disorder under Section 38 U.S.C. 1110, and we also have a claim for service connection for an undiagnosed illness under the provisions of 38 U.S.C. Section 1117. In theory, appellant can be awarded service connection for both a Section 1110 and 1117. It is the Secretary's position that this case is outside the control of Roebuck and its progenies.
Counselor, could I get you maybe to move the microphone?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sure. Is this better? It's also the Secretary's position that the Board and appellant representative has always treated these as two separate claims. If you look back at the development of the claim, appellant first filed for service connection, and the RO treated it as a direct service connection. It wasn't until after a December 1996 hearing where he started to allege some symptoms that could be related to Pershing-Goff symptoms, and the board chairman advised him that he should be filing a separate claim. After that board hearing, appellant did so. He filed a Pershing-Goff symptom claim, and therein he alleged that he had aching joints, stomach trouble, and memory loss. It wasn't until the development of the claim, after we had a remand for the direct service connection claim that year, that on a medical examination that the shortness of breath came up. And it was unclear during the development of the claim whether it was linked to a diagnosed disability. He had several pneumonia, bronchitis, and also, as the claim was developed, environmental inhalants, some allergic reactions to that. We believe that this case is separate from Roebuck and that Roebuck dealt with one diagnosed disability. Here we have two distinct claims for two distinct conditions. Therefore, a diagnosed condition cannot be part of the 1117 for an undiagnosed a disability resulting from an undiagnosed disability.
Why was service connection denied for a lung disability in the 1998 board decision?
In the 1998 board decision, it was denied for not being well-grounded, Your Honor, the direct service connection claim.
And why was it not well-grounded?
I believe he did not meet the threshold to show the that he had a current disability, the Lincoln service. It was primarily the Lincoln service, the chronic. He didn't exhibit a chronic medical condition that was either incurred in or aggravated in service.
Ms. Quaggle, in the board decision, 2004 board decision, board states at the bottom of page 10 and the top, or R10 and R11, thus due to lapse of time, continuity of any in-service symptomatology may not be conceded, and service connection for a lung respiratory disorder may not be granted on a direct basis, and cites 1110. Is that another decision of the board with regard to direct service connection?
No, Your Honor, it is not. It is the Secretary's position that the 1998 decision is the final decision on Section 1110. Here, the Board, I disagree with Appellant's counsel respectfully, that the Board cannot sua sponte take jurisdiction over a final decision. If anything, the Board was just being clear in its reasons and basis of denying an 1117, saying you cannot get service connection for 1117 for the shortness of breath symptoms that you're claiming, because they're actually related to the 1110. To the extent that the Board did make that statement, I would say it's harmless error since the 1998 decision is final.
Counselor, couldn't the diagnosed conditions be secondary to the undiagnosed situation?
In this case or in theory, Your Honor?
In this case.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Specifically, 1117 deals with disabilities for an undiagnosed illness. And this court has spoken in Stankovic, saying the very essence of an undiagnosed illness is that there is no diagnosis. These are two different legal pathways that the appellant has the right, and potentially, in theory, he could be awarded service connection for either an 1110 or an 1117. If we make it secondary, then we're taking away potentially a service connection award that he could be awarded.
Was there ever a medical examination or opinion with respect to this precise issue in this case?
Of whether it was secondary?
Yes.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. It started as all of our medical examinations. We were asking, is there a diagnosed disability? If he does have a diagnosed disease, what can it be attributed to? And if he doesn't, because 1117 has to do with constellation of symptoms. And since he started with his claim saying he had aching joints, memory loss, stomach trouble, it wasn't until medical exam that we were able to find out that he had the shortness of breath, and all those other symptoms fell by the wayside because they weren't objective. There was no objective medical evidence to pursue that. So I would say they're not secondary.
So on page, on record 267, which is the 1998 board decision, finding of fact, it appears as though the basis for the not well-grounded claim is that there was no nexus, that there was a current lung disorder, but there was no nexus.
Just a moment, please. Thank you. I believe he did have pneumonia that was diagnosed in 1994, some flu-like symptoms. I'm just reading ahead, excuse me. It appears in my reading of page 271 that there was no competent evidence that he currently suffers from a lung disorder on a direct basis.
What page are you reading? Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I'm reading on page 271, the very first paragraph starting with, in this case.
Well, that's what raises my question. Mm-hmm. In this case, there's no competent evidence that the veteran currently suffers from a lung disorder on a direct basis, which can be reasonably related to the veteran's periods of active service. It seems to me he either doesn't have a lung disorder or he has one and it can't be reasonably related. That sentence is left open. But if you go to 267, finding a fact, it says there's no competent medical evidence linking the veteran's current lung disorder on a direct basis to service. So was it that he had a current lung disorder, but there's no nexus? Is that why they found no? Not well-grounded?
I believe the nexus was missing in this case for the direct service.
So he has a current lung disorder in 1998, and it's deemed to be not service-connected on a direct basis.
Right. This veteran had
because
two,
it was not well grounded.
Correct. And this veteran also had two periods of service. He had one that was outside before the Persian Gulf War started, and then he had a section that did occur during the Persian Gulf. It's also the Secretary's position that if the court were to rule that a Section 1110 and 1117 are separate legal theories of entitlement, that in theory the veteran could be awarded for both of them. it's less detrimental to the veteran to have a ruling in that capacity. Specifically, if you were to rule that 1117 was part of an 1110 claim, then the veteran would have to produce new material evidence once this 1110 claim was denied. That would stop the VA's duty to assist if we were to start wrapping this up in that manner. I think it's clear on the face of the statutes that a diagnosed illness cannot be part of an undiagnosed disability, and it's the Secretary's position that BOGS controls this case.
What was the diagnosed illness in 1998?
It might have been, Your Honor, and I'm not, I can't certify to this, but I believe it was, I'm pretty sure it was pneumonia was one of the symptoms. I just need to clarify that. I have acute pharyngitis. It looks like he was diagnosed in February 1996, which is on the record at page 219.
But what did he have currently in 1998?
Well, he wouldn't have had pneumonia, but he did have it in the past, so... I'm just going on with the private medical records report, which is acute pharyngitis. Flu-like syndrome that other family members and friends had reported, and pneumonia. I think this is one of the reasons why it was, you know, potentially not well-grounded.
But if he didn't have a current disability, then what was denied? His claim for a lung disorder?
Well,
doesn't that support Mr. Carpenter's theory that it was an overall lung disorder claim?
Under McLean, this court has said that you don't, as long as you have a current disability during the claim, your stream claim, then you can get service connected. So in theory, he could have been service connected for either the condition of acute pharyngitis or pneumonia if he had it during this claim, which he did. He just didn't have it, it appears, at the time of the rating decision.
So if we look in 1998, your position is that whatever his lung disorder was, it was denied.
On a direct basis, yes, Your Honor.
Well, was it a lung disorder denied on a direct basis and a lung disorder proceeded to be reviewed on a Gulf War syndrome basis? Or was it a lung disorder denied on a direct basis and something other than a lung disorder processed under the Gulf War?
I would say that it was a respiratory disease under direct service, and for the 1117, the very nature is a multi-symptom illness is what he's claiming. And he claimed that he had aching joints, memory loss, stomach condition. Upon examination, we discovered that really the objective medical evidence was shortness of breath. We didn't know that. VA didn't know that at the time as we were developing the claim. And it wasn't until further examinations after the 1998 decision that we were able to narrow what the objective evidence was and if he could potentially be awarded service connection.
So if he had appealed the lung disorder in 1998 and it was affirmed, that wouldn't preclude the processing of an undiagnosed multi-symptom claim.
Right. If
that would include some lung issues.
Absolutely, because Boggs speaks to that distinguishing claims upon distinct medical diagnosis is more accurate than relying on the symptomatology. So while we are dealing with potentially now, looking at this case, that we're dealing with the same lung entity, the same lung organ, we are dealing with separate diagnoses, separate diseases. One is a disability resulting from an undiagnosed disease, and one is a diagnosed disease.
So in Roebuck, where they had a lung disorder based on tobacco, or the very same disorder based on asbestos, that's different than this case, which is a lung disorder denied on a direct basis and some multi-symptom that's still being analyzed by VA.
I believe so, Your Honor. I think Boggs potentially narrows Roebuck's holding in that capacity.
Or vice versa.
Does the wording of the current board decision before us impact the status or the situation in 1998 when that other board decision was rendered, remanding portion?
Are you speaking to...
The 2004 board decision before us?
For clarification, Your Honor, are you speaking to how they listed the issue, how they couched the issue? Is that your question?
How they discussed it, such as the appeal originally came before the board. The appeal originally came before the board, record at 2. The claim was amended, record at 2. They remanded an issue, record at 2. They referred to the personal hearing in 96 and nothing later. They referred to it to include as due to, which would sound like it included direct service connection as an issue before them. The November statement of the case cited by the board for notice, which wouldn't be applicable to this. An April 97 notice type letter that might not be applicable to this.
Sure.
Cites the direct service connection as possible basis for award, as was pointed out earlier. Denies service connection on a direct basis, as was pointed out. But when you look at the actual order, it seems to be limited back to the chronic disability overall.
Sure.
But does the wording of this 2004 board decision impact what happened in 1998?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. I believe that the case of Gerald v. Nicholson speaks to that the court that the board couldn't take jurisdiction over a claim that was final, and.
Short of the board, the chairman opening, reconsidering?
Certainly that's one avenue.
Can the board not do that sua sponte?
They can do that, but in this case they did not. Nor did appellant elect to either file a recue or to ask for reconsideration himself. As a matter of fact, appellant was here in, I believe, 2001, and same case, that's before us now, and accepted a Stigall violation, and it went back and remanded. At this point, at that time, he didn't allege anything regarding that. The 1998 was what he couches as a 9 final decision. So while the board might have been inartful in its discussion, certainly the record, the evidence before us and the way that the agency has treated this case has always been two separate claims. We've always adjudicated it as such, and we maintain that they are two separate legal claims.
What's your view of the Harris decision, which term decisions by the board for which appellate notice had been given? I believe that involved TDIU, if I'm not mistaken, so it might be a little bit different. The term, to put it in terms of jurisdiction as opposed to it's a final board decision, we could decide it, but it's so interrelated, we're going to send it back because of judicial economy.
Right. I don't believe these claims are inextricably intertwined. They cannot be. The language on the face of 1117 specifically says that once you get a diagnosed condition, and here we have a diagnosed lung disorder, it falls outside the purview of 1117. So 1117 can never help an 1110 claim. Just because you're denied for one doesn't mean you're automatically denied for the other. They are two separate legal entities, and a veteran should have the right to pursue both claims under those theories.
When the Secretary has denied a claim, lung disorder, and in the process of continuing to proceed this multi-symptom disorder, is there any duty on the Secretary to advise the veteran that if additional information were discovered that might re-raise the issue of a direct service connection for a lung disorder, to so notify the veteran?
The veteran would need to file a claim or somehow allege that he would like to revisit this 1998 decision, whether it's under a motion for cue or a new material evidence claim. I believe it's the Secretary's position that it is a final decision in 1998, and therefore we wouldn't have a duty to go back to every veteran for every decision that was final and say, by the way, if you come up with new evidence 6-8 years later, you know, keep that decision in mind.
And when VA comes up with the new evidence, there's no duty to notify the veteran either.
I don't believe so. I don't believe that the VA can just sua sponte take jurisdiction over a final decision. Are there any further questions, Your Honors? Well, in conclusion, the Secretary respectfully submits that this honorable court should dismiss appellant's argument regarding direct service connection claim under Section 1110 for lack of jurisdiction. Additionally, the Secretary asks this court to reaffirm the April 2004 decision. Thank you.
Thank you. You have 10 minutes, Mr. Carpenter.
All right, I'd like to begin by looking at the different ways in which the board has characterized the issue in this case. In 1998, the board characterized this issue as entitlement to service connection for a lung disorder, including service connection for a chronic disorder manifested by shortness of breath due to an undiagnosed illness claimed as secondary to Persian Gulf service. In 2002, when the board remanded the case, it identified the issue at 313 in the record as entitlement to service connection for shortness of breath as a chronic disability resulting from an undiagnosed illness. However, in April of 2004, the issue was characterized as service connection for a respiratory/lung disorder as a chronic disability resulting from an undiagnosed illness. We heard as part of the government's presentation here that there are what the government refers to as 1110 claims and 1117 claims. I have been doing this work for a considerable length of time, and I am not familiar with such a distinction. Those are clearly legal theories of entitlement to compensation under different statutory provisions. But in the VA Form 21526, which every veteran files for the formal application for compensation, makes no such distinction and is asked by the government when he makes application not to indicate that he or she is asking for an 1110 claim or an 1117 claim. And Judge Lance, I think you raise a fascinating question in relationship to the implications of the undiagnosed condition as developing additional disabilities that are approximately due to or the result of the undiagnosed condition under 3.310A. Notwithstanding the government's position, I think the government is wrong. Clearly, what 3.310A provides is if you are entitled to compensation for, under the Persian Gulf presumption, an undiagnosed condition, then any disability which develops, which is proximately due to or the result of that service-connected condition, is entitled to additional compensation. So clearly, the need to develop this case is what was circumvented by the board's original decision that it was not well-grounded in 1998 and by the board's July 2002 development memorandum, which impermissibly narrowed the review of Dr. Plum's 2001 opinion. In 2001, Dr. Plum indicated that he found that the veteran suffered at that time from a diagnosis of bronchitis, and he also offered an opinion that Mr. Tyrus's shortness of breath was due to an undiagnosed illness that was at least as likely as not due to his Gulf War service. Now, that supports completely the claim for presumptive service connection, and that should have been the end of the matter. But the board in 2002 found that there was a disconnect because there was a diagnosis of bronchitis. Even presupposing that that bronchitis was not directly service-connected, he has established, based upon Dr. Plum's medical opinion from a VA doctor, entitlement to the presumption, and that he had shortness of breath that was at least as likely as not due to his Gulf War service. That's the end of the matter under the presumption. But what the board did was they sent a development memo that said, don't look at Dr. Plum's evidence again and go out and get another medical opinion. And that medical opinion stated that the veteran was having some kind of allergic reaction, and yet that same medical opinion examination indicated that he had no allergic conditions. Now, you can't have allergies and have, or excuse me, you can't not have allergies and have an allergic reaction. And yet that was the conclusion that was offered. And it was on that basis that this claim was defeated by the board when it had that evidence in 2004. Mr. Tyrese is not asking for reversal in this case. He is simply asking for what he was entitled to under 19.9. And that is a remand for clarification from Dr. Plum as to what he meant in his 2001 opinion. That 2001 opinion is sufficient to substantiate this claim. If that is affirmed by the VA on remand, then these benefits should be awarded, and they should be awarded all the way back to the date of the original claim.
What is the date of the original claim if you accept the government's theory that there's two intertwined in here?
Well, as the government suggested, it was the government itself that suggested during the development of this claim originally, prior to the 1998 board decision, that a separate theory of entitlement be submitted. So it goes back to the date of the original claim.
Same either way.
Same either way. Unless there's any further questions. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
All right, the case will be submitted. We will come down and greet counsel.
All right. This honorable court is adjourned to further order.